So hello again, and here we are again with the One Shot Football Podcast. I'm your host, Steve McBain. You can get all your latest football news at www.oneshotfootball.com. We're back this week. We had a few audio problems last week, so I must apologise for that. But we've got a cracking show today, and what a lineup! We have two One Shot Pod regulars, Mr. Ryan Marsden and Chris Pax. In fact, not just regulars; these are budding legends, I would say, and their first time together on the show. Guys, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yep, tip top.
And what a surprise we have for you guys. We have our very own live Brazilian footballer in the studio. We have Leo Rocha, Coach Leo, as he's known. Leo, how are you?
Yeah, great, thanks.
Good. So, Leo, you're going to be talking to us a little bit today about youth development and what's maybe going wrong in world football. Leo, do you want to tell us a little bit about what you're doing in Singapore?
Yeah, man, thanks. Yeah, what I'm doing is I open a football school, so I manage like a football school for youth, for kids from 2 to 16 years old, and we basically focus on the technical development. So we work on the technical skills, on the dribblings and all those kind of things that normally they don't have in the school.
I mean, from what I've seen with the youngsters, it's based on small pitches and small games and little passing triangles and things. Exactly. All the things that the UK aren't doing. Yeah. Well, we'll hear a little bit more from Coach Leo, particularly in part two. We'll be really focusing on youth football. But in this week's news, I think the biggest story of the week was, well, apart from Jose Mourinho not leaving Chelsea, was Brendan Rodgers leaving Liverpool and the appointment of Jurgen Klopp. I mean, Chris, good, a bad appointment?
I think it was, my gut feeling is a good appointment. I think that it's a club that suits him very well. So they're kind of very much like his previous club. So I think overall it's going to be a good appointment. Whether they can do the sort of pressing style, whether they've got the players right now for this, or it's going to take a season or two to transition, I'm not too sure.
I mean, Ryan, I mean, is Klopp, do you think, is he going to have to work with the players he's got? We've all heard about this famous Liverpool transfer committee, or do you think he'll have his own say and...
I think, well, he's very astute, very well respected, there's no doubt about that. I think he wouldn't have gone into a job if he wasn't able to have proper control. I'm actually looking forward to seeing how they develop. He's not going to have a chance to really change the squad too much. He's got to work with the players he's got, obviously minimum until January, but I don't think he'll go nuts. Work with the players. I'm looking to see how a quality manager can extract the best from what's a mediocre squad.
That's a good point. I mean, the Premiership has lost a lot of its luster and a lot of the best players, particularly to Real Madrid and Barcelona. But this is, one of Europe's premier managers. So it's great to see him coming into the game, crossing swords with Mourinho and the likes of Van Gaal. Now, one thing I wanted to ask you guys about is, I mean, Brendan Rodgers, I actually have a bit of sympathy for the guy, I have to say. I mean, his net spend over his time there was give or take, I think around 100 million. Now giving that, I accept that Carragher and Gerrard were not the forces they were, earlier in their careers, but the influence they had on the club was massive. He lost both of those guys, Luis Suarez, who Liverpool were simply not in a position to replace, and also Raheem Sterling, who I think is probably the most replaceable of all of them. I mean, he has lost, some major, major players there and hasn't really spent a huge amount, whatever they say about the gross, the net spend isn't that big. I mean, is it unfair or...?
I think the main thing about Rodgers, his success was bringing some of the players through. So guys like Sterling, like Coutinho and Sturridge, they weren't regular first teamers when he started. He brought them through to kind of... very good international players.
So even Suarez, I mean, became a world-class player under him, yeah?
True, but the downside, I think, is his tactics, not really understanding, not so much understanding, but getting a way to play that there was a Liverpool style. It kept on changing from 4-1-3-2 and 4-3-3, and it was, with the diamond there and everything. So I think that was the major downfall for me.
I don't know, I've got a slightly different opinion on that. It's not really the players. For me, Liverpool is a club where passion and emotion really come to the fore. And it's like a 12th man, it really is. And I don't think Rodgers brought that to the club. And as Steve, you said, losing those personalities, Carragher, Gerrard, etc. As a manager, you're going to have to really go a big step to get that family
I mean, one of the things, however badly Liverpool have been doing, they remain one of the biggest clubs, you know, in the world. And I just wonder whether the likes of, you know, Lovren and Lallana, good players that they are, whether they have the mentality to play with that pressure. I mean, Leo, you know, as a player, if you got a move to, you know, to a really, really big club, is that something that could affect a footballer and bring his performances down if he can't handle the pressure?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I think emotional is very important in football, right? And if you just make a move for a big club and if you are not really strong mentally and you're not ready for to face this pressure that you have, it really can affect your football skills and your level. You can really feel it on the pitch. Yeah.
Okay, well, one thing we will definitely get from Jurgen Klopp is lots of emotion. Now Sunderland also lost their manager. I don't think that was any surprise seeing Dick Advocaat's press conference last Friday. So they'll be looking for the sixth manager in 4 years. The names in the frame are Sam Allardyce, Sean Dyche, Nigel Pearson. Steve Clark's ruled himself out, saying his wife would kill him, which I guess says everything what he thinks about the area. Now, given he's from Ayrshire in Scotland, that's not saying a lot. And an amazing statistic is that the already unnamed next Sunderland manager is already the fourth favourite to be the next sacked in the division. Guys, any thoughts on who should take this job?
I think Allardyce will get it, but I think...
Will he want it? I mean, or...
Well...
Yeah, it's an ego thing. It's still a reasonably big club, and
But he was hugely disliked on Tyneside. Will it be any difference on Wearside?
I think there'll be less expectation on Wearside. I think when he went to Newcastle, there's a huge amount of expectation to finish in the European places. I think now it's just a case of escaping relegation, and that'll be a huge success. But I personally think there's another name in the hat. There's the third favourite is Bob Bradley, and I think he'll be an interesting choice, and he'll be the one I would go to if I was Sunderland.
Okay, well, we'll watch this space. Now, one club that haven't got rid of their manager is Chelsea. One of the theories that was put forward to me by a friend in London yesterday, by people far more intelligent than him, I might add, is that the reason for Chelsea's drop-off this season is that Mourinho, in his first two seasons, just demands everything from his players, physically and emotionally, mentally. He doesn't rotate much. The players play, you know, nearly every game as trusted lieutenants, and effectively what they're saying is that the players are just shattered. I mean, Leo, can you do that to a professional footballer in 2 years?
Yeah.
You think? I mean, is that an argument that we think maybe holds water, or are the players just not playing for him, or what is... I mean, you know, with a team, I mean, how much difference does the manager really make? When you've got top-level professionals, guys like, you know, Eden Hazard, Cesc Fabregas, is the manager making that much difference?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, definitely, yeah. The manager is the boss, right? He's the head of the club, the team. I mean, if the manager, he can, of course, improve the team, and he can also kill it. He can also destroy the atmosphere. If he can manage all these players, especially with all the ego, all different characters of players, all different personality, if the manager can hold it properly, it can really make a disaster. Yeah, and I think Mourinho. I heard a lot about him. Especially yesterday, I saw an interview from Deco, and he said that Mourinho has a very good control for the team, you know, like he play a game, like he play like he's a tough guy, he's a very snobby guy to the media, but inside to the players, on the changing room, on the daily work, he's really close to the players, he's really protect the players, they do a lot of jokings, when he needs to talk serious, of course he does, but he's totally different guy on the pitch or indoor, like inside the house, than what he shows in the media, I think.
I mean, certainly, I mean, he's handled some of the biggest egos in the game very well. I mean, Ibrahimovic, I mean, just waxes lyrical about him. Didier Drogba is another who, you know, would walk through walls for him. But at the same time, I mean, his last season at Real Madrid, you know, there was factions in the dressing room. He'd fallen out with particularly Iker Casillas, I think Pepe, and probably Sergio Ramos, was it? There hasn't been too much talk of, you know, anything within the Chelsea dressing room, but something's clearly...
I think maybe it goes back to the point where you say they are worn out. He postponed the pre-season this year, I think, by a month. And some of the players have come back unfit. Costa mentioned yesterday that he was overweight when he came back. So for the first month of the season, I think they weren't ready to start. And that's maybe they've got into losing mentality almost. They've kind of lost their confidence and it's become a bit of a vicious circle. So I think maybe it's just all about the conditioning for me.
Well, I'm going to be at the Aston Villa game. So I'll be hoping for a little bit better. Put it this way, if Chelsea don't win that, I think I will be at Mourinho's last game in charge. Now, the other thing that's been going on in the football world this week is the last round of the Euro qualifiers. My country, Scotland, went out last night. We plucked defeat from the jaws of victory again as we drew with Poland and the Republic of Ireland had a fantastic win against Germany. So congratulations to them. Northern Ireland are also through. Unfortunately, Albania fluffed their lines by losing at home to Serbia. But I think the biggest story is Holland, who are basically one decent Turkish result away from going out. This is clearly not a wonderful Orangey team, but I would suggest that the Euros without the Dutch is a lesser experience.
Indeed, I think, and they're not going to get there, are they? Let's be honest. They need to win the last two games to have any chance. I think Turkey will have enough in their bag just to get the third spot, and it would be a shame not to have them there. To be honest,
for me. Yeah, I will be sad not to see them there.
I have to agree with that. It won't be the same tournament. It's a shame.
And I would just like to say that all the qualifiers are fixed because, I mean, 24 teams are meant to get through. Scotland is not there, and Ireland took 4 points from Germany. Come on, Germany, what are you doing?
So I think you've got to give a appreciation to Northern Ireland as well. They've had a fantastic run of results in there. They just qualified yesterday, so congratulations to them.
But it clearly doesn't say much about international football, which we'll talk about later, that Kyle Lafferty is scoring that many goals. But anyway, we'll move on. Oh, sorry, and one last one to mention there is Iceland, which is another great story. And I think they've probably got their best ever team together. So good luck to them next summer. Now, unfortunately, there's been more bad news coming out from FIFA this week. Well, good or bad, depending on how you look at it, but it's a shame for the game. Sepp Blatter and Platini both been suspended for 90 days by their own ethics committee, along with Volker. I mean, Platini is, he's meant to be the favourite to replace Blatter. I mean, does he have any credibility left? Can he even stand? Or,
well, the circumstances for this are a little bit funny. I mean, they've almost been sentenced before there's been a fair trial.
Quite right, I think, in this.
I'm not defending anything that's gone on there. It's just rotten to the core. But I think this is very much a knee-jerk reaction, and I think it's backfired. It's turned into what was already a farce.
This payment that FIFA made to Platini was at 1.3 million. I mean, 9 years after he'd done the work, but curiously just before the elections. I mean, it's circumstantial, but
It's very strange. Is Blatter taking a fall and taking Platini with him and creating a void there for his own man to come through? I don't know who's going to be favourite now to take on the role, but I don't think Platini's got a chance to get the role.
Can FIFA even remain as it is? I mean, this is such a fundamental rotten. It's not even a core. It's rotten to the edge. It is. Can FIFA come back? I mean,
you look at the English FA, who've been so anti-Blatter, yet have not removed their support for Platini yet. I mean, Platini, I guess now, he can't carry out his UEFA duties either now, I don't think.
He's suspended from all of football, so you know.
Well, it's a story that will rumble on with, unfortunately, no real winners and only losers. But hopefully we will be able to draw a line under this sad story sooner rather than later. That takes us to the end of part one, and we'll be back with part two. Okay, so here we are back with part two of the One Shot Football podcast. You can get all your latest football fixes at www.oneshotfootball.com. Now, in part two, we're going to be leaning a little bit on our special guest today, Coach Leo. Leo, as a young player who was very successful, in your younger career in Brazil, you moved at an early age to play in Switzerland. I mean, that was probably, I'm guessing, quite a culture shock. For a young player, how does it feel to move abroad? And what are the big things for a youngster when they move abroad?
Yeah, I mean, I think the first thing is the cultural, right? About if as a young player in Brazil, I'm talking from my experience. The most difficult thing is the cultural, is how the social relation, like the people relation, how is the approaching, how is the, so of course the language is also really tough.
I mean, at least in Switzerland you didn't have to worry about pubs and nightclubs, right? I mean,
it's, yeah,
lights out at 9 p.m. right?
So. That was the good and the bad thing actually, because yeah, but and there's a big Brazilian community there, and they party a lot. They know how to party. But I think it's really tough for a young guy leaving your country, moving to somewhere else, and because of your dream, because of your career, and because of the football, or it's a lot of things, right? That make it really difficult. But I see now the club. It's like Ryan said, it's everything based on how the club supports the player. No, like if you go alone, or if the club support you to bring all your family, or if they support you with the house and they give you all the.
Well, I remember. I mean, Barcelona moved Messi's entire family. I remember when Juninho joined Middlesbrough. They signed Branco, I think, almost just to look after, you know.
Yeah, that's important.
Juninho.
Yeah. It's important for you to have someone from your family or something. Like that. I didn't have it, so for me it was really bad, because. Maybe if I would change something in my life, I would change this.
I mean, as a player, if you're unhappy off the pitch, I mean, does that really affect things on the pitch?
Totally, definitely. Yeah. When you are on the pitch, you can, of course, you try to switch off, to forget about everything off pitch, but you can't make it. You know, like if you are having problem at home, or if something is going wrong with you, definitely will affect you on your game. Yeah, definitely.
That's regardless of ability, right? You know, so it must be a real challenge. Look at Di Maria. I mean, you know, the personal problems just
exactly. Or Neymar just now as well. He had this problem with the taxes, and we can see how he's not playing well. Maybe it's a coincidence, but it's. Maybe this is affecting him on the pitch as well, you know.
I mean, I think off field is you know, clearly part of it. I mean, I remember when there was the two Leeds players who were involved in that nightclub fracas, Lee Bowyer and Jonathan Woodgate. And Lee Bowyer carried on regardless, but they said that Jonathan Woodgate was just mentally, with this court case hanging over him, was just broken. So I guess it affects different people in different ways. But I mean, one of the things, when I look around the international scene at the moment, there just doesn't strike me that there's a lot of teams out there who are particularly good. And this is where you can't just simply buy players or whatever. And I just wonder, is there something wrong with the development line, you know, of 15 to 21-year-olds? I mean, is this a symptom of more players moving abroad at an early age? I mean, presumably the academies and things that they're attending are the highest, you know, standard, the facilities, the training. Would they be better off, do you think, you know, for instance, with the Brazilians, would they be better off spending more time in Brazil, do you think?
Yeah, I think so. I think now it's too premature, right? They try to formate the player too early, I think. They are rushing too much professional, like to make a contract with a guy with 15 years old and to sign him on the professional with 17, as early as they can. I think that they are not spending enough time to really build the player as a technical skills, as a tactical skills. They are just trying to make a professional player quickly, because we need new players, or we don't want to lose anyone. I talk on the Brazil view. The Brazilian view is there is a rule and law that if the player doesn't have a contract, like a professional contract, he can leave the team any time he wants. I mean, I talk about 16, 17, 15 years old, they're younger than that. So what they are doing is, the team, they are trying to give them, like, this also is spoiling the kids as well, because they are 13, 15 years old and they have a huge contract, and they otherwise the team will just lose them from the.
I mean, is this part of the problem, that they have so much money so young that there's no incentive to, you know, to improve? I mean, you could draw an analogy in the golfing world with Michelle Wee, who was this, you know, golfing prodigy on the women's tour. I mean, she was playing in men's events when she was 15 or 16, and then she's done okay, but I mean, she had this massive contract with Nike, and then she just, you know, she fell away. There's just no incentive to improve, I guess. Or... Mm,
exactly. And it's also the problem as well is the manager, right? All the players, they have like, they manage and the manager say, man, if you don't need if he's not happy with the coach, for example, if the player is not happy with the coach because the coach is pushing too much, and then the manager said, don't worry, man, I just put you somewhere else, I will bring you to Europe, or I will bring you to east of Europe, like Ukraine, or where the money is now. So they are not really worried about improving their skills, they are not really worried about playing a good football, but they are just worried about get a good contract, go to Europe or somewhere there, sign a good contract, or even in Qatar or Middle Arabia or Middle East. There's a lot of young players that they live in Brazil with 15, 16 years old and just going, even...
It's a real conflict, isn't it? Because what are the knock-on effects? And then this is what we're talking about, is the international teams don't seem to have the same ability across the squad that they did 20 years ago. And it's really a fundamental problem because the clubs are in a race to each other. They want to make sure they get that potential first, so that other clubs.
Look at what Real Madrid.
Get earlier.
I mean, Real Madrid just spent a fortune on that Norwegian kid last year. Was he 15, something like that? I mean, because you just almost can't afford not to buy him.
What would you do as a 15-year-old? You want to play. You want to play from 15 all the way through to 21. So then those clubs see you. If you're already fulfilling that at 15. You know, again, psychologically, do you ease off?
I mean, Leo, one thing, you know, I wanted to ask was, when you have players at, you know, at 17, 18, who have the ability to, you know, to play, you know, with the men, if you like. I mean, obviously, you know, the guys like Messi and Maradona who, you know, played from a very, very young age. But when players are 17 and 18, the bodies are still developing and things, is it better for them to play with players of their own age and just, you know, be introduced gradually? Or is it better for the development to just get them stuck in with the guys and the...
No, definitely, I think they need to take their time. No rush, not jump steps, like just step by step, work on the technical ability, focus on it, play on the same age. Of course, they can go graduate, like hey, they can join the professional team for training, for just to see the atmosphere, to go to some friendly games, and to be introduced slowly, slowly, right? But I really think they should stay on the under 17 or under 20 or whatever and focus on it. And another point as well, what we're talking is like on the youth football, they are not focused anymore about building players, but they are focused on results. The pressure was on the coach as well. The coach, before my time, the pressure was on them to produce players. The focus was, the pressure on the coaches, man, for the under 16 coach was, we don't need a title, we don't need to be champions, we need to formate players, we need to build players. So the focus was on the coach to work on each player to potentialize the professional player, like to make as many professional players as we can.
Well, I mean, I think this is an interesting point. I mean, are you developing players to win the under 15 World Cup, or are you developing players to be fully grown adults? I mean, I remember playing under 10s football, and we were told to shoot high because the goalkeeper wasn't tall enough to reach the bar because we were playing on a full size pitch. I mean, that was the mentality. It was about winning that game. So rather than place your shot in the bottom corner, you're just told to shoot high because the keeper couldn't reach it. I mean, obviously, hopefully things, even in the northeast of Scotland, hopefully things have moved on a little bit. But I mean, you think that, I mean, there obviously needs to be some sort of element in competition in games to keep people interested. Would you cut down the amount of competitive football then that young players are playing and concentrate more on you know, training and skills?
I think so. Of course, they have to win, right? Of course, win is part of the game. But if you play a good level, if you play a good football, if you focus on the skills, on the touch call, the passing, the win is the result, is a consequence. Not like if you play good football, if you focus on the good football, you play good football on the pitch, there is no other way. That's the win. You get the 3 points in the game. So I think going the other way, right? We are. I talk about the 18, and the 16, and the 14, whatever. I'm talking about those ones. They're not professional ones. They are worried about winning games and playing. Doesn't matter how you play. And I think the focus should be play well, do a good football, and the consequence will be you win the game or you win the title or you win the championship anyway. So I think the point is focus on the play a good football. We especially in Brazil, talking about the Brazil, we lost our identity, right? We are famous everywhere in the world about joga bonito, about play a good football.
But that's what made Brazil great, certainly for me growing up, is because you hear the stories that at the age of six, you're playing on the beach with that small ball on the streets
with Pepe.
And that's developing skills at an early age, or developing football skills.
Exactly.
Other countries weren't doing that.
I would say that every person from any country in the world who's a football fan, apart from maybe those in Argentina, wish they were Brazilian. I mean, Brazil is the team. It's the one that we, you know, whenever our team goes out of a major tournament, the team you look to for excitement has always been Brazil.
Yeah, and now we are losing this. Especially looking back home, looking to the coach, to what they talk, to all the interviews, to all the media as well. I think it's everyone's fault, especially after the 7-1, the disaster.
I wasn't going to bring that up.
But I can't forget it. Like, I remember about this every day. I think, especially after this, everyone is saying everything in Brazil is wrong. Everything is wrong there. And we need to look at the European football and we need to copy them or we need to learn with them. Instead, if we look to ourselves and look what we were in the past, and see where have we lost the way? Where did we took the wrong direction?
But I think from what I can see, I'm not sure of the figures, but Brazil seem like a net exporter of young talent. They don't have the young talent developed in Brazil right now. So all the guys are going overseas, where tactically they're okay, but culturally, psychologically, maybe they're not so much. The standard of play in Brazil right now is shocking. The local leagues, Flamengo, Fluminense, all these teams are really poor right now. Mm-hmm. They play a lot of matches as well, so they're very spread very thin. But talking about being an exporter, that kind of comes across to, you know, what about the European countries where we're not exporters of youth talent? What's going wrong there? I mean, we've got guys that are technically very sound. The training schools, the coaching is very good, but they're still not getting to the next level. So for me, there's something going wrong with the psychological training of the guys. Their mental state is not good enough. Perhaps it's they got too much too young. But you don't get guys like Gary Neville coming through who doesn't have the most talent, but he was going to become a professional, whatever happened, you know?
I mean, there's loneliness, and we've talked about this previously, but you've got 17-year-old, 18-year-olds who have the potential to be future first team players. They go out on loan to get the experience. Is it too much experience? You know, I mean, it's such a fundamental conflict, I think, in terms of how to set this up. It's difficult.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at all the European nations, to me, it just feels like they're not really developing players at all like they used to. I mean, you know, we were just talking off mic about the Italy team. It all used to be household names. You know, Germany, who arguably are probably the best nation in the world at the moment, don't have a recognised striker. I mean, Thomas Müller's a great player, but he's an attacking midfielder. The Dutch are terrible. I mean, just getting back to Brazil for a second, just because they used to be just this massive conveyor belt. You know, you've got 200 million people and, you know, football is like a religion there. I mean, what would you change and what needs to change in Brazil for Brazil to get back to where, you know, everyone wants them to be?
I think is that to look back who we were, like how we played, how we used it to play. Where is the samba football? Where is our identity?
But could you do that within a working structure? I mean, does the Brazilian Football Association, I mean, what do they need to change?
Yeah, I think this is about everything that we have talked here, right? It's about the coach mentality, the club's mentality about not focus about the results, focus about building players, focus about these technical skills, about the improvise, you should try something, not just follow the instructions exactly, the touch call, you cannot pass the line, you should just go straight and cross it, all the balls in the far post, and you cannot try anything else. You just need to do exactly what I'm telling you. Everything else that you try is wrong. I think the football is getting too boring, I think, in Brazil when you talk about that. We are trying, as I said, we try to copy the European football, and then we cannot reach the European because we have different type of football. We have different DNA, we have different foundation of football, idea about football. And so we are not doing what we were supposed to do, or what we are used to do. And we are not doing what Europeans does, about the tactical, about the education about the game, like the really do what the coach does, or tell you what to do, follow the instructions. Because I think the problem is this. I think the problem is we are too scared to try. No, not me. I mean, the players are too scared to try. They are too scared to be their own. And when for example, Douglas Costa, he went to Bayern, and then he was doing some skills, some nice tricks, some nice dribblings, and it was a huge fight because the player doesn't want to get dribbling. If someone tries to dribble you, it's they think that it's like an offense, that he's not respecting you. And so I think football is getting too boring and on some kind of view, on this kind of aspect. And for the Brazil to be what we were supposed to be, I think we need to start there on the foundation with on the 10, on the 12, on the 14. And this takes time, right? It will not change from day to night, but it takes like few generations to give it back what we were supposed to do. Tell the players that you don't need to worry about result. You are 15 years old. You don't need to worry to go to Europe so soon. You don't need to worry to get a good contract. We just worry about build your skills, focus on your developing, focus on your technical, how you control the ball, how is your first touch, long balls, dribbling, your shooting, all those technical skills that's important for you to be a good player. The contract, the Europe, will come for you as a consequence. Yeah.
Okay, well, there we have some wonderful Brazilian insight and some real Brazilian passion. So plenty of for food for thought for everyone there. So that'll take us to the end of part two, and we'll be back with part three. Okay, so here we are with part three of the One Shot Football podcast. So after the glamour and the samba of Brazilian football, we're unfortunately back with the mundane of the Premiership, but we'll do our best to make it entertaining for you. Now, what I've asked the guys to do is just to have a look at the Premier League table, and it's time to put our school headmasters caps on and give each team a little report card so far, and basically we can mark them from A to D, or if they genuinely are in need of an F and must do better. So let's look down the table from top to bottom. So kicking off with Manchester City, Ryan, what are your thoughts?
Well, I've given them an A-. They are top of the league, as they should be, but I've given them minus really because the hints of fragility, you know, they've still got a tendency to not do very well on any given day. So A- for me.
Chris?
I'm a bit harsher. They definitely should be top of the league. They've got the best squad. They lost a couple of games. For me, it's a B.
Well, I've given them a B- myself because, you know, the amount of money that they've spent. They've had some great performances. I mean, Aguero, you know, was absolutely fantastic at the weekend. But, you know, they've looked very brittle as well. I don't think they're pulling up any trees, but you know, they're top of the league. Anyway, Arsenal. Ryan, your favourite team?
B-. You know, not a lot of people may know, but I actually fancied them to be, you know, real title challengers. Yes, they're second, but for me, they've really under-delivered on their potential this season. So, B-.
I'm not quite so harsh. I've given them a B. If we were to take into the European performance as well, then it would be a lot worse than that. But B for the Premier League, second place, not bad.
Well, I give them a B- as well. I mean, I think the fact that they're within 2 points of City, and you're giving City an A and Arsenal a B, is a bit counterintuitive.
I don't like Arsenal.
Well, then give them a D then. I mean, come on. I think Arsenal, it's the same old Arsenal. They flatter to deceive. They're a good team on their day. But anyway, Manchester United, Chris.
For me, it's a B-, and that's a generous B-. There's lack of pace, the tactics aren't right, I'm not sure where they're going, and Rooney is well off form.
I've given them a B+, because as opposed to Arsenal under-delivering on potential, I think Manchester United have over-delivered.
How much money have you spent?
They've over-delivered because they're not a very good team and we're still 2 points off the lead. So that is a B+.
Well, I've given them a B-, but the more I listen to you rabble, I'm inclined to give them a C+. I mean, you know, this is a club who spent so much money. I think I probably would have given them a B-, but that performance at Arsenal was just turgid. I mean, they were absolutely terrible. C+ for me. Anyway, Crystal Palace, fourth place.
It's an easy one, this. Top marks, A+.
Can you have an A+?
Yes, I've given it.
Okay, I've given them an A- because I never give out A's.
A-? They're batting well above their weight.
They've lost three games.
They've only let in 7 goals this season.
I've given them an A as well. I think they've been a breath of fresh air, and I think they're someone that genuinely... What I like about them is there's someone that goes into the games against the big clubs and actually gives it a go. So, an A for Palace. Now, Leicester City.
Based on my last one, it's the same again, A-, just because I don't give out A's.
Well, I've given them an A.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Leicester City, fifth place. I mean, I still think, you know, as long as they stay up, they'll be happy with the season. But fifth place going into the international break is really, really fantastic for them. Now, West Ham.
I've given them an A as well. I think it's a very good start to the season. They obviously big changes over the summer, manager, and I actually thought that would be quite a trouble for them. But no, they've done very, very well. I've been proven wrong, so A, sixth place.
For me, it's a little bit lower, B+, because they've had some great results against the top-level teams, but against the lower-level teams, they're struggling. They're a good counter-attacking team. They're going to struggle to create chances against the lower-level teams.
I mean, I gave them a B+. My worry about West Ham would be they've had some cracking results against the top teams, but they're also unlikely results and ones that they're not likely to repeat. The results against the other teams and the ones you'd expect them to be around haven't been quite as great. I mean, they've got, what's this guy, Dimitri Payet? I mean, he is just, what a footballer he is. I mean, he had the most assists in Europe last season. Most assists and most chances created, more than Messi. I think he created 150 chances or something last season for Marseille. And he's doing it again for West Ham. He's scoring goals, he's creating chances. He's a wonderful football. I mean, they're a good side, but whether they can stay up there, we'll see. Anyway, Everton.
That's a B+ for me. I like the look of them. I like the strikers, the attacking guys. They've got Deulofeu, Barkley's playing well, Lukaku's playing well, Naismith as well. So I think for them, they've done pretty well. B+, and Martinez is showing his worth.
Oh, Steve might disagree with that. I've given them a B because they're exactly where they should be. Simple as that. No pun intended. They are seventh. That's where they should be.
It's probably where they finish. I've given Everton a B, but I can't stand it because I can't stand Roberto Martinez. And I'll say it again, he's a charlatan. God, it really pains me. But I have to say, they've actually played some good football this year. I watched one game I saw them play against Southampton. They were absolutely superb. And against Chelsea, they simply destroyed Chelsea. But then again, the only team not to do that this season is Arsenal. Now, moving down to eighth place and Spurs.
Average team and average score.
Can you actually just mark them? Can you just write Spurs? I mean, it should just be its own mark.
It's
just,
average C.
Yeah, I've got down B, but you're right, C. They're not where they should be. They should be higher up. They're turning things around right now, but I think,
I gave them a C+, because as much as the results have been mixed, you do seem to feel with Pochettino that there is a method and a plan. They haven't spent vast sums, in the last two seasons. They're bringing some players through. The average age of the team is pretty young. They're trying to do things rather than these quick fixes that they've kept going for. There does seem to be at least some long-term planning, but We shall see now. Southampton recovered from a poor start, up to ninth.
Yeah, I've given them a B. I would expect them to finish in the top 10 anyway. They are recovering, they're improving. They played a great game against Chelsea. Mane looked superb.
I've been a bit harsher there. I've given them a C because of the start they had, and you know, come to think they're a good team given the recent season.
Yeah, I give them a C+, but maybe they're suffering a little bit from you know, false expectation after last season. Now, Liverpool, recently departed Rodgers and Jurgen Klopp coming in. I gave them a D because Liverpool in 10th place is just not acceptable.
I've given them a D as well. It's a terrible season so far, and I'm not surprised that Rodgers has gone.
Full house of D's, that's what I give them as well, for all those reasons.
Well, there you go. 3D for Liverpool. Now, Swansea City.
For me, that's a generous B-. They started very well, but since they beat Man United, they've trailed off and they've been looking pretty average. So let's see where they go from here.
Yeah, I've given them a C. I expect better things from Swansea, which you wouldn't really expect to say, but they're a good team. They are a good team. They're well organised, and you know, languishing mid-table is probably a bit of a disappointment.
Well, I gave them a C as well, which, you know, again, a little bit like Southampton. It just shows you how far the expectation has grown with these clubs. What would concern me about Swansea this season is, I just hope this isn't the year that it catches up with them, that they don't have a goal scorer. I don't think that Gomez, I mean, I think he had that little run where, you know, everything is sort of came off his backside when in. But that's the one thing that would concern me with them. Now, Watford, I've given Watford a B because I think Watford, anything above 18th is just fantastic for them. So, you know, they've had some good results.
Yeah, I've given them a B+. They didn't start particularly well, but they gained a few results recently. So, yeah, they're doing okay.
Agreed, yeah. B, there's a good gap between them and the relegation places. So that's a job well done so far.
Now, Norwich City, this is my second club this year because I'm a real, real big Alex Neil fan, and I think if you stick with this guy, he will do wonders for them. But some mixed results, and they were really, really disappointing last week. I've given them a C+ because, I mean, you know, they are mid-table, but what are we thinking, guys?
B-, so close to you. I think they should have done a bit better. There's a result against, is it Leicester or last weekend? It was
Leicester. Yeah,
I thought they were a little bit unlucky, but it showed they just weren't.
Well, if they won last weekend against Leicester, they went level on points with Leicester. Yeah. And given all the plaudits Leicester had, but I mean, they were pretty well beaten, I think, by Leicester. So, Ryan,
I've given them a C. That's where I'd expect them to be. They're going to struggle. They'll take some points off people, but they're more likely to give some.
Think they'll stay up?
I do think they'll stay up because I think there are other clubs in bigger problem situations than them.
Now, in 14th place, we have Barcelona. Sorry, Stoke City, but full of Barcelona players and full of Champions League winners. Guys, what are we thinking of Stoke?
I've given them a C- because it was a terrible start. They've won the last two games, which is an improvement. I think they'll finish mid-table. There's no problems there. Don't rate Mark Hughes as a manager, though.
Oh, don't you? No, I do. I like you.
And so the Stoke fans love him, don't they? No protests or anything.
They're playing lovely football, but they're just not getting any results.
No, I've given them a C. I think they should be performing better, actually, given the quality of the depth of the squad.
Well, I give them a C-, but again, they're another club I've got my eye on this year. I mean, you know, given that Chelsea are just doing so badly. But I think with Stoke, there's definitely some signs that they're starting to improve, starting to gel a bit. They've got so many good players. I really like that Arnautovic. Bojan's fit again. And I think, you know, once they get Shawcross fit, I think he's the missing piece in the puzzle. But I give them a C- as well. Now, Bournemouth.
Bournemouth, for me, was B-. They've been playing okay. They've had some good results.
Maybe horrendous it's a bit harsh. Luck with injuries.
But I was going to say, Wilson, he's out for how long? I think it's season, is it?
Yeah,
it's a real terrible, shame.
So, yeah.
And also Tyrone Mings, which I'm disappointed because I just want to keep saying his name, but you know.
Bournemouth's a B for me. If they're not in the bottom three, that's a good season. I hope they maintain it. They're a club that I enjoyed.
Well, me too as well. B is indeed for Bournemouth. Now, 16th place Chelsea, and let's get it said, it's an F. Chelsea can't be in 16th. Come on, this is terrible. Guys?
Yep, it's an F. They've lost four games. They've conceded 17 goals.
17 goals. That is astonishing. Big F.
Terrible stuff. Now, West Brom. Tony Pulis, how's he doing?
Well, I would have thought better things. Tony Pulis is a great manager, moulds his teams very well. So to see them 17th is not great. But look, it's still very close. I mean, one win and they're mid-table, so I've given them a C.
I've given them a C as well, but they've not been playing well. And, well, Pulis has never been relegated, has he? I've got a feeling this season could be the first time.
Yeah, C minus for me. I'm not. There's something about this team I don't like. I just don't quite like the balance of it. It doesn't look great at the back. I think Pulis, I mean, give him a bit of time, but they don't quite look as solid for me as I'd like them to see. Now, into the bottom three. In 18th place, we have Aston Villa and Tactics Tim. What are we thinking?
Well, I would have given them an E, but we can't give E's, so it's going to be a D.
E for error and getting Sherwood in? Or?
So a D, yeah, I think they won the first game, didn't they? And then since then, they've just done nothing. Not quite as bad as Chelsea, but not far off it. Tactics Tim, terrible manager. Love his delays, though.
Worst team in the Premiership, F, and they will go down.
Yeah, I agree with Ryan. I think F, I think they're absolutely rubbish. There's nothing to like there. Sherwood, it's a little bit like having your team managed by a fan. You know, he looks so despondent when they get beat and he's so happy and chipper. Well, I think they did win once.
Well, didn't he say that the game against West Brom and Birmingham City were the two biggest games in the history of Aston Villa? I mean, come on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Football managers are prone to hyperbole, but that was stretching it a bit. Now, 19th and Sunderland.
For me, it's an F. Terrible. They're going to go down.
Concur. F.
Yep, I think there's no doubts there. I think the next manager will be a brave man. And Newcastle, Steve McLaren's brave new world. Bottom of the table after 8 games.
That's why I've given them an F, although they did impress me earlier in the season with their attitude. You know, they finished last season.
But I mean, they've just down tools. I mean, the way they were just waving Sergio Aguero through for those goals. I mean, it was great to watch, but they were standing watching it as well.
To watch.
No, I've given them an F, but I don't think they're going to go down this year. I think they're going to escape the relegation. They've got too good a team there. They've got some very good players.
Really? Who?
Well, there's some of the new signings this year.
Well, I mean, the young guy up front, Mitrovic, I think, has definitely got some potential. But other than that, I mean, Wijnaldum as well, I guess, is a decent player. But the Dutch guy, Ryan, yeah, that's it. But anyway, so a trio of Fs to finish now, which just leaves us with our quiz. And I think I might be handing out some Fs at the end of this as well. Now, we're going to focus a little bit on Brazil as we have such a special guest with us in Coach Leo today, but I'm going to just start with a couple of questions on Ronaldo, which some stats I saw during the week. Now, since joining Real Madrid in 2009, Ryan, what percentage of Real Madrid's total goals has he scored?
Percentage?
Mm-hmm.
I would say 40%.
Chris?
Yep, I think you're not far off. That's going to be around 35%.
35% from Chris.
Something like that. I'd say 45. Say 40. Yeah. So let's go 45.
Yeah. Well, Ryan was straight out of the blocks with a bullseye. 40%. That is absolutely staggering, and that's over 6 years. I mean, it really is.
The consistency. We've said it before, but it's amazing.
Yeah. Now, out of Ronaldo's last 85 direct free kicks, so free kicks which he's attempted to score from, how many has he scored? Out of the last 85.
He's not scored many, that's for sure.
No, he doesn't score that many.
Yeah, right.
I'll go 10.
2.
Go 5.
My God, we got another correct answer from Chris with 2.
Wow. 2 out of 85.
2 out of 85.
It's like
and there's no one who has the guts to say, I'll take this one. Now, talking about somebody, you know, another player, leading us on to the Brazilians, who didn't score a lot of free kicks from the amount he took. But Roberto Carlos, he put himself on the map with that outrageous banana bender, you know, years ago. The one where he hit across the valve with the outside of his foot.
Yeah.
But who can you tell? Exactly. Who can you tell? Who were Brazil playing?
France.
Yeah. Okay. You've got to wait for the questions, mate. I was going to say, who was the keeper? Who was the keeper there?
Barthes.
Okay, now.
How many cigarettes did he smoke?
Yeah, exactly. But what was the year?
Wow. I would say 19... 97.
97 is correct. Second go. What was the name of the tournament?
Le Tournoi.
Le Tournoi. And who was the winner of the tournament?
Wow.
Good question.
I would say Brazil.
Well, I thought you would say Brazil, but... Any raises on Brazil?
No.
You don't know the third team in the tournament?
No.
England. Alan Shearer raised the trophy in the most boring way I've ever seen a trophy scored.
He's not used to doing it, so that's why.
Now, there is only one team in world football who has never been beaten by Brazil and has a winning record against them. Can you name the country?
Whoa.
I'll give you a clue. They've played four times against Brazil and they have two wins and two draws.
Oh, in Norway.
Norway, yeah, absolutely. Okay. Now, Ronaldinho, as we all know, was wonderful for Barcelona, but from which team did Barcelona sign him?
PSG.
PSG, correct. Wow, look at this. We've got some Brazilian knowledge here. And Ronaldo, the real one? Who did they sign Ronaldo from?
From Holland.
PSV.
PSV. And Romario?
As well.
PSV, okay, there we go. Now then, it's generally considered that Carlos Alberto's World Cup final goal in 1970 is one of the greatest team goals ever. I mean, a great finish as well with the outside of the foot. But who passed the ball to him?
Pelé.
Pelé. But who tipped Pelé off that he was running down the right flank?
Oh, wow.
He had his back to goal at the time, gave Pelé the nod.
Yeah, Tostão was
Tostão, yeah, the there you go. You've got it as well. And how many outfield players were involved in that move?
Wow, that was amazing because the ball started on the back, right? It started on the back and they run on the back.
Well, the central defender, I can't remember his name, he beat four Italian players in his own half. The central defender.
And then passed it backwards to get the big ball.
That's it again. I would say... Eight
is spot on. There you go. Now,
I'm in awe here.
In the 1994 World Cup final, which Brazil won on penalties, who missed the penalties for Italy?
Oh, Baggio missed one.
Baggio.
The final one, yeah.
Cannavaro. No. What's his name? The guy that was here.
Was Scalacci playing then?
But he was the greatest sweeper of all time. Franco Baresi.
Baresi as well, yeah.
And they missed one more.
Massaro.
Daniele Massaro. There you go. Now, AC Milan forward, great player. But who missed for Brazil?
Brazil, the defender, Márcio Santos.
Márcio, wow, look at this knowledge. Okay, now can you tell me the three players that scored?
Dunga, he scored in a good celebration. Romário scored.
Romário. One more.
Dunga, Romário.
We mentioned him earlier. Hell of a left foot.
Branco,
yeah, there we go. Now, obviously, Branco came into the team as one of his compatriots was sent off earlier for one of the worst elbows of all time. Who was responsible for that elbow?
Leonardo.
Yeah. And whose skull did he fracture?
Well,
it was US, was it?
Yeah, USA.
On 4th of July.
USA, yeah.
US in the National Day. He got this as a present. Yeah, they scored on that day. Was 1-0.
This is a hard one actually. Tab Ramos.
He
might have been there for a while.
Yeah.
Now World Cup 2002. How many goals did Ronaldo score?
Seven.
Well, you can't have two answers.
Give me one. No, I was just seeing cloud. I would say seven. Yeah.
Seven.
I think we got seven with the record, wasn't it?
What, six?
Eight.
Wow.
Eight.
Now, during the tournament, which is the only team that he played against that he didn't score against?
Eight in 2002.
2002. Turkey?
No, he scored in Turkey. He went to England.
Yeah, you guys really don't get the clue, do you? England, yeah.
England, exactly. Ronaldinho.
Ronaldinho.
Of course, yeah.
With that well-intended free kick.
Yeah.
But who, however, was voted player of the tournament and won the Golden Ball? In 2002.
Oliver Kahn.
Oliver Kahn. Oh. Yeah. So, which takes us to the end of our quiz, and can you name all the Golden Ball winners going back to its inception in 1962? So this is the most valuable player at the World Cup. Wow. 1962? Okay, I'll give you a clue. Brazilian?
62.
I actually got most of these right. They're actually not as hard as you think. 62?
Pelé?
Garrincha?
Garrincha, yeah. 66? God, what is wrong with you guys? Deary me. I mean, you know, you can lead a horse to water, but come on. I mean, 66, but by the way, apparently, allegedly was a fix. Allegedly Sepp Blatter's first involvement in football.
Yeah.
1970.
Pelé.
Pelé, yeah. 1974.
Probably the Dutch guy.
Beckenbauer's
Dutch, is he? Wow, new revelation. Beckenbauer is Dutch. Anyway.
Cruyff?
Anyway, yes.
Cruyff, exactly. Cruyff. Yeah.
Now, 1978.
Beckenbauer.
78.
Winners were Argentina.
The little one left for Maradona.
No, he was just stood at the side of the pitch with his boots, I remember.
Oh, yeah.
No, go
Mario on. Kempes. Mario Kempes. Now, 1982, the greatest World Cup ever for me. Well, as a Brazilian,
yeah,
you
we
should
have a lot of Brazilians, ones on that, and
Zika?
Good players on that time. I don't think a Brazilian will be too.
Wasn't a Brazilian, but a Brazilian should remember.
Yeah. No, actually, you should forget about
it. Scored a hat trick against Brazil?
Oh, Paulo Rossi.
Paulo Rossi. God. Now, 1986. Easy, this one. This is the easiest one of the lot.
Maradona,
exactly. Absolutely. Yeah. Now, 1990.
Did we mention him earlier?
Scalacci,
yep, absolutely bang on the head. 1994, USA 94.
Romario.
Oh,
phenomenal.
And 1998? France 98?
Zidane?
Is it Ronaldo?
Ronaldo, yep. 2002 was Kahn, as we said. 2006? Italy, the eventual winners.
Oh, Cannavaro.
He got World Player of the Year that year, but.
Yeah, I don't remember much about 2006.
Nope.
Okay. Any questions?
No.
The winner was Zidane, so clearly FIFA.
Oh, Zidane.
Clearly, clearly the world does not like Marco Materazzi. Now, 2010? South Africa?
Okay.
This is a tough one, actually.
Robbie.
Any clues?
Well, ex-Manchester United player.
Veron?
Nope. His strike partner got sent off for a flagrant handball.
More.
Two big clues.
Forlan.
Diego Forlan.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's right.
And lastly, and the last World Cup, 2014.
Struggling after that last one.
Oh, I'm looking at that award.
2014, he stood there looking absolutely miserable as Germany walked off with the trophy.
Messi.
Lionel Messi, yeah. So, anyway, so that takes us to the end of today's pod. So a big thanks to Chris, Ryan and Leo. Thank you, guys. I'm your host, Steve McBain, and we'll be back with another podcast next week.